Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marjorie Cohn, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, who assesses the legality of Trump's threat to declare a national emergency in order to bypass Congress and get funding to build his southern border wall. Donnie Bloomfield, a student at Yale Law School's Rule of Law Clinic, who discusses the NAACP lawsuit launched in Connecticut that challenges the widespread practice known as prison gerrymandering, and Ronnie Cummins of the Organic Consumers Association, who examines the proposed Green New Deal legislation and its potential to unite small farmers and working-class families to promote renewable energy and advance economic and racial justice. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The long-delayed presidential election in the Democratic Republic of the Congo fell into confusion as the National Elections Commission named Felix Tshisekedi the winner, who was trailing by double digits in pre-election polls. The candidate who took second place, former oil executive Martin Fayulu, challenged the credibility of the election results in court. The Catholic Church in the DRC, which had mobilized 40,000 election monitors, disputed the commission results but refused to name Fayulu the winner. Inside the Congo, it's widely suspected that Tshisekedi cut a deal with the ruling party's outgoing president, Joseph Kabila. It was hoped that this election would usher in the first peaceful transfer of power since U.S. ally dictator Mobutu Sese Seko seized power in the early 1960s. The election outcome is now in the hands of the Constitutional Court, which can affirm the official results, order a recount, or call for new elections. There are growing fears of political violence across the DRC as the election outcome remains in doubt. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is the source of two-thirds of the world's supply of cobalt used to power electric cars and smartphones. An investigation by ProPublica found that over the last 4 years, U.S. veterans sent by the U.S. government to receive health care from private physicians have endured longer wait times, and taxpayers have been paying higher costs than standard Veterans Administration care. In 2014, the VA established Veterans Choice as an alternative to long waiting periods for treatment. The program, launched quickly with little time for basic preparation, awarded two large private health contractors, HealthNet and TriWest Healthcare Alliance, the ability to charge $2 billion in overhead, exceeding the limits of private insurers under the Affordable Care Act. The Trump White House has prioritized the privatization of the VA and is often at odds with veterans groups who support the quality of care their members receive in VA programs. According to the VA's Inspector General, prior to the Veterans Choice Program, HealthNet and TriWest provided similar services for one-sixth the cost to taxpayers. Moreover, audits found the two contractors overcharged the U.S. government $140 million between November 2014 and March 2017. The companies are now under criminal investigation for excessive billing. Still, the Trump administration has expanded TriWest's contract without competitive bidding. 2 years ago, New Jersey approved the Criminal Justice Reform Act, which uses a risk assessment algorithm to determine if a defendant should be jailed without bail pending trial. According to In These Times magazine, the goal of the legislation is to phase out money bail, which has resulted in tens of thousands of low-income defendants sitting in jail. Under the New Jersey law that employs algorithms, some defendants are denied bail completely due to risk factors such as having a history of failing to appear for court dates or violent crimes. But last July, more than 100 social justice groups, including the ACLU, the NAACP, and MoveOn.org, publicly came out in opposition to New Jersey's algorithm system, arguing that the data driving conditions of bail, such as prior failures to appear and arrest rates, reflects systemic biases against people of color. They recommended simply ending money bail and dramatically reducing pretrial detention without introducing risk assessment tools. However, supporters of the New Jersey reforms claim it has led to a 25% drop in the state's pretrial prison population over the last 2 years, while they recognize that the law is only what they call a critical first step. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After more than 3 weeks of a partial U.S. government shutdown, where more than 800,000 federal workers have either been furloughed or forced to work without a paycheck, there's been little progress toward negotiating a solution. President Trump's demand for Congress to allocate $5.7 billion to build a wall along the length of the U.S.-Mexico border triggered the shutdown soon after right-wing commentators criticized the president for signals that he was about to back down on his election campaign pledge. But before his January 8th nationally televised address on what the president described as a border crisis, Mr. Trump threatened to declare a national emergency in order to secure the funds Congress denied him to build his border wall. In 1976, Congress passed the National Emergencies Act, which permits a president to declare a national emergency when he deems it appropriate. But the act offers no specific definition of emergency, and constitutional scholars have challenged the legality of declaring an emergency to justify an end run around Congress. Although in recent days Trump has said he's backing off the idea of an emergency declaration, the possibility still exists that it could be employed to end the government shutdown. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Here she talks about her recent article titled, If Trump Declares a National Emergency, He'll Be Breaking the Law.
Well, the only national emergency besides real and national emergencies like climate change, which is a bona fide national emergency, has been created by Trump. Now, in terms of declaring a national emergency, which he may see as the only way to reopen the government without giving in on his wall demand, he would be on shaky ground. During the Korean War, President Harry Truman tried to seize the steel mills to avoid a union strike that would have shut them down, and Truman was claiming authority in support of the war effort, and yet the Supreme Court shot him down. All the justices were Democratic appointees, and he was a Democrat as well. The 6-3 majority shot him down and said, no, you can't do that. And the seminal case is Youngstown versus Sawyer. Justice William O. Douglas wrote a concurring opinion, and he said, the president cannot usurp Congress's spending power to approve money to pay for the taking of the steel mill's private property. It would be a similar situation here. The Constitution gives only Congress the power of the purse. Justice Robert Jackson, who took a leave from the Supreme Court to be the chief U.S. prosecutor at the Nuremberg war crimes trial, wrote a concurring opinion with three prongs, and that is the litmus test for measuring executive power. And I should say that Justice Jackson cited Hitler's use of a temporary suspension of rights to take full power in Nazi Germany. So I know that people get nervous when you make comparisons with Nazi Germany, but Justice Robert Jackson did that himself. Now, in terms of the three-pronged test from Youngstown, which we must apply and the Supreme Court ultimately would probably apply to determine whether or not Trump's declaration of a national emergency was legal, are as follows. The first prong is that when the president acts with express or implied authority of Congress, his power is at its greatest. Congress has not appropriated $5.7 billion to build Trump's wall, and if he were to declare a national emergency to fund the wall, Trump would not be acting with the authority of Congress. the second prong of the Youngstown test is that in the absence of a grant or prohibition by Congress, the president can rely only on his own powers. And Justice Jackson said the president would be acting in a zone of twilight where he and Congress may have concurrent authority, or it would be unclear how the distribution of power between Congress and the executive would be. It depends on the situation. So Trump would probably try to invoke the National Emergencies Act of 1976, which was actually passed to limit the president's ability to declare a national emergency, although it does include the responsibility of Congress to override a declaration of national emergency, and that would take two-thirds of the Congress. But that act would not apply, would not support Trump's declaration of a national emergency in this situation, because that act only allows the president to divert funds that have not been obligated and use them for construction projects that are necessary to support the military. Now, there's been some talk that he is considering taking some of the funds that have been allocated for disaster relief, such as in Puerto Rico after the hurricane or in California after the fires, and use them for his wall. But they have been obligated. They've been obligated for those disasters. But assuming that he could use them, assuming they hadn't been obligated, he would have to use them for construction projects that are necessary to support the military. Now, he would argue that the military is at the border helping the Customs and Border Protection because he sent thousands of U.S. troops to the border. But the use of the military to enforce domestic law, and immigration is domestic law, is prohibited by the Posse Comitatus Act. So any attempt by Trump to declare an emergency in order to justify diverting funds for his wall to help the military enforce immigration law would violate the Posse Comitatus Act. And then the third prong from the Youngstown case is when the president seeks to circumvent the express or implied will of Congress, his power is at its lowest ebb. He can only rely on his own constitutional powers, and presidential claim to such power must be scrutinized with caution. In addition to being illegal, and I think it is, it's also an abuse of power. It's a cynical political stunt. I think that everybody realizes that, or at least most people realize it. It's an abuse of power, and abuse of power was one of the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. So the House of Representatives, which is now in Democratic hands, could issue articles of impeachment against Trump. I mean, there's obstruction of justice and all kinds of other charges they could bring as well. But impeachment is a political process, according to Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers. And abuse of power, even if it's not a crime, is still grounds for impeachment.
That was Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's author of the recently updated edition of Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. For more commentary and analysis of the president's emergency powers in the context of the current government shutdown, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In most states, except for Vermont and Maine, incarcerated citizens cannot vote. Yet inmates, for the purpose of determining voting representation, are counted in the population of the town that hosts the prison where they are being held, rather than in their home communities. Now, the National NAACP and its Connecticut state affiliate have sued in federal district court in Bridgeport to try to win a reversal of this practice. It's the first statewide lawsuit of its kind in the U.S., where there are currently more than 13,000 persons incarcerated in Connecticut. In addition to the NAACP, five individual voters are party to the lawsuit, including one formerly incarcerated person. The plaintiffs come from cities that have lost electoral representation due to this practice, which disproportionately affects people of color, especially African Americans. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Donnie Bloomfield, a student at Yale Law School's Rule of Law Clinic, which is representing the NAACP, its Connecticut affiliate, and the individual local plaintiffs in this suit taking action to stop Connecticut's practice of what's known as prison gerrymandering. Here, Bloomfield explains the status of the lawsuit and what plaintiffs hope it will accomplish.
What our clients are suing the state about is a practice called prison gerrymandering. And prison gerrymandering is a practice where the state uses incarcerated persons in allocating its legislative districts by counting incarcerated persons where they're held, where they're incarcerated, instead of where they live and where they're really from. And what this ultimately means, to just get to the bottom line of how this harms our clients, is it dilutes the votes of people in the cities and the places where incarcerated people are ultimately from. The way you can look at that is by thinking that for every 9 votes or so for people in some of these places where these prisons are located, it takes 10 votes to get the same electoral power for the larger districts in Connecticut. Because even though prisoners are not allowed to vote, even though incarcerated people are not allowed to vote, their bodies are counted towards the districting of these northern districts, predominantly white districts. And what you see is that in the cities and in the predominantly African American and Latino communities where a lot of these incarcerated people are from, they are not having those people counted towards their electoral power, even though it's in their interest that the southern legislators are also working.
Not only does it dilute the voting power of the communities they come from, it adds to the voting power of where the prisons are located.
Exactly. It's this perverse double punch is one of the ways that we talk about it in the lawsuit, where you see these predominantly white areas having, you know, largely African Americans and Latinos very disproportionately being brought there and counted towards their electoral power, even though these folks can't vote, and that power and those votes are being taken away from the families and communities where these incarcerated people are ultimately from.
So what are you trying to accomplish exactly?
We're trying to get the federal judge to declare this practice of prison gerrymandering unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment and ultimately have Connecticut stop it by counting incarcerated people where they're really truly residents instead of where they happen to be held.
And the 14th Amendment, just remind us, why do you claim it's unconstitutional under that amendment?
Sure. So one of the clauses of the 14th Amendment protects equal protection under the law. And according to a number of Supreme Court cases, this is where the right to one person, one vote vests. So that protects the right of one person to equal power in their government. And that's what we're looking for here, where we don't see that equal protection and we don't see that equal representation because you have this vote dilution going on in the South and empowering those northern districts with the bodies of incarcerated people.
So has this ever been done before, to your knowledge, anywhere in the country?
There have been a very small number of lawsuits, federal lawsuits brought against prison gerrymandering. This is the first one that's challenging on a statewide basis. There was a successful suit in Florida that challenged a municipal practice of prison gerrymandering, and there was a case in Rhode Island where that was ultimately unsuccessful that was challenging a local practice of prison gerrymandering there. But this is the first statewide challenge that's being brought.
It seems like for decades there was this tough on crime view by pretty much all politicians and people in communities too. And now it seems to be shifting for a variety of reasons, one of which is that it's ridiculous how we incarcerate like some very high percentage of all the incarcerated people in the entire world. So I was wondering if you think the shift in the perception of prisoners, in other words, instead of locking them up and throwing away the key, there seems to be more interest now in considering what happens when most of these people, when they get out, because most of them get out eventually. Do you think that will make a difference in terms of what you're trying to accomplish in your lawsuit?
Definitely. And I think that the NAACP obviously really cares about the larger issues and the individual plaintiffs that we represent in this suit. They really care about criminal justice reform, and it's something that they see this as part of, this lawsuit as part of a broader effort to ultimately reduce some of the real terrible consequences that have resulted from these tough-on-crime measures and from these extremely long and arduous prison terms, and as part of a broader push to see incarcerated people as people instead of just prisoners.
Can you say anything about the timeline?
What's happened so far is that last year the NAACP and the rest of our clients filed suit, and then the state made a motion to dismiss, and we responded, and the issue is now sitting before the judge on whether to allow the suit to move forward and move forward, hopefully into discovery and ultimately trial, and hopefully a final verdict in our favor. So that's where we're standing right now. We're waiting to hear from the judge on what he thinks the merits of the suit are to advance into the next stage.
That was Donnie Bloomfield with Yale Law School's Rule of Law Clinic. Learn more about the Connecticut prison gerrymandering lawsuit by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Late last year on December 10th, around 150 protesters from the youth-led Sunrise Movement were arrested outside incoming Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi's office, demanding bold action on climate change. Newly elected New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez addressed the demonstrators and put forward a proposal for a Green New Deal that calls for a 10-year plan to neutralize the United States' greenhouse gas emissions, move the nation toward adopting 100% renewable energy, and reduce growing income inequality. While the Sunrise Movement has received praise for forcefully bringing the issue to Democratic House leadership, neither Speaker Pelosi, House Majority Whip Steny Hoyer, or Chair of the House Rules Committee Jim McGovern have endorsed the Green New Deal proposal and have given early indications that they regard a program of this breadth and depth to be a bridge too far. Between the Lines' Richard Hill spoke with Ronnie Cummins, co-founder and international director of the Organic Consumers Association, who assesses the Green New Deal proposal and offers his perspective on its holistic, systemic approach that has the potential to unite small farmers, working-class families, and organic activists in a movement to promote renewable energy conversion while also advancing economic and racial justice.
The basic idea is that we've got a crisis of the system like we had back in the 1930s in the U.S. that can't be fixed with small changes here and there. We need a package of political reforms at the federal, state, and local level that can address the literal climate emergency that we're facing, but that can fix other major problems at the same time that preoccupy people, and justifiably. When you have 80% of the public living from paycheck to paycheck and a third of the public in the United States living in literal poverty, you can't expect people to wake up in the morning and think about solving the climate change problem. People wake up in the morning and they think about how they're going to pay their bills. They think about the health problems. They think about the student debt. They think about the fact that they don't make enough money to cover their bills, much less purchase organic food. They think about a lot of issues that are all important, and they don't wake up thinking about preserving organic standards or carbon sequestration through regenerative organic methods in grazing and crop production. But that doesn't mean that these folks can't become our allies in the food and farming and climate change movement. It just means that we have to address the basic necessities of people as we move to solve what leading climate scientists are now telling us is we've got to turn things around aggressively in the next 12 years or we're going to lose control and it's going to be horrible. We're not going to convince everyday people to forget about their health problems, their job problems, their families' problems, their kids' lack of job opportunities, their deteriorating environment and poison water and all these other things. But if we package what we believe, which is a revitalization of the organic and regenerative sector, into a package like the Green New Deal that says basically we'll give jobs to everyone who wants to work, rebuilding our society, rural and urban, for renewable energy and sustainability, they'll sit up and take notice. The brilliance of the Green New Deal is similar to the brilliance of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal in the 30s and 40s, which is it's not a single reform. It's a package of reforms designed to alter a degenerate system, which is what we have right now. But I think we're going to be able to build a very large national coalition, bigger than we've ever had in the food and farming movement, around this issue. Because we can't go forward with a peace movement over here, a food movement over here, a fair trade movement over here, a climate movement over here, economic justice movement over here, social justice movement. We've got to break down the silo walls and work together, because we do not have unlimited time to solve these problems. And the longer the problems go unsolved, as we can see from recent political developments in the U.S., Brazil, Hungary, Poland, really many places, is we're creating a climate for fascism if we don't deal with the everyday needs of working class people and the majority of the population. We can't go forward as a climate movement anymore thinking that we can actually save the climate just based on the strength of our arguments that we've got to stop emitting fossil fuel emissions and that we've got to stop doing destructive land use practices. We got to come together in a way that people have not in the United States for 70 years. And one thing we can draw hope from the fact that Mexico has taken a decisive step in this direction. In July, the Morena Party, which is called the Movement for National Regeneration of Mexico, swept the elections, not just the executive branch, but both houses of Congress. And they came into power December 1st. But they are already making sweeping changes to implement what can only be described as a Green New Deal, where they're trying to deal with poverty, corruption, migration, agriculture, food sovereignty, climate at the same time. And they're immensely popular in Mexico. This is the most popular government that there's been since the 1930s, when there was the last decent government in Mexico, which was patterned on the New Deal, Lázaro Cárdenas. So there are signs across the world that this has been a very dark hour, 2018, but that we can now move into a new era if we'll wake up and get organized.
That was Ronnie Cummins, co-founder and international director of the Organic Consumers Association. Learn more about the Green New Deal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, KYAQ in Toledo, Oregon, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.